It's time now for the Todd Leonard Show. Leave those negative stories behind as we focus on the positive and hear from those who give back and help others. Let's start your day with some inspirational stories. Now, here's your host, Todd Leonard.
Good morning, everyone. Hope everybody's enjoying this incredible weather. It's, I think we're going to set a record. It's going to be in the mid-60s again today. I had a great show last week with Steve Alford. I mean, from Roxbury Rotor Club, he knocked it out of the park. I mean, talk about a guy giving back. And when I reached into the community further to see who else we could bring on who really embodies the idea of helping the community, helping others in need, I researched and had the great fortune of contacting Maria Sabatier, attorney at law, who's actually dedicated many years since June of 2003 to Deidre's House. And we're going to explore with her background and the great things that they do to help the kids in need and who've gone through such heartache and such difficulties. So, Maria, good morning. Thank you again for waking up and joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Todd. I really appreciate us meeting today so we can get the word out about the needs of child abuse victims in Morris County.
Yeah, and as we were talking before the show started, very serious subject, but, once again, so vitally important for the community right here in Morris County. Deidre House has been doing really very, very important things for many years. So, Maria, if I can, each week I like to, explore a little bit. We were joking a little bit. We're both attorneys at law. This isn't going to be a deposition, but I do want to ask you some questions, a little bit about your background and kind of how it all started. So, if you can. And where are you from?
I'm originally from Parsippany. I went to Parsippany High School, as did my husband.
Okay, and were you blessed with children?
Yes, we have three children who are actually two have just graduated college, and one is in college. And they were all very involved with volunteer work at Deidre's House. The whole family has been involved and been very supportive of what I've done. Sometimes, it's a very difficult job because of what I see, and my family has really been very supportive in the work that I've done, very important to me.
Right, and we're going to definitely, get into the nuts and bolts and detail about the Deidre's House in Morristown and the incredible work they do. And I know we were going over a little bit about your background, and you are an attorney, and before you got involved, with giving back and being involved with the Deidre's House, you were a practicing attorney for a number of years. Am I correct?
I was. I started off in commercial real estate, but then went in-house where I was an international contract attorney for Hughes Network Systems in Germantown, Maryland. And my position there, I was responsible for negotiating international communications contracts, mostly in developing countries. For instance, I was in China 3 weeks out of every 5 weeks. And it was very interesting because I was in China in a time when most Westerners had not been involved in commercial business in China. And I was one of the few women there that was in the late 80s and early 90s. So one of the skills I took away from that was trying to find solutions to very difficult problems and also being able to use my legal skills to negotiate solutions to complex problems, which really stood me in good stead when I came onto the board of Deidre's House back in 2002. I really had no experience in not-for-profits, and when members of the board asked me to take over as executive director in 2003, I really had to reach into my toolbox as an attorney and a negotiator and somebody who had to solve very complex problems to really look at the state, particularly the financial state of Deidre's House and our programming and the services that we were going to deliver and come up with some out-of-the-box and really interesting solutions to some difficult problems. So back in 2003, the reason why they asked me to take over was Deidre's House was in very bad financial straits at the time, and they could no longer afford to be paying an executive director. So myself and Trish Lewing, who is a child psychiatrist who actually lives in Mendham, New Jersey, we agreed to come off the board at that time and run Deidre's House pro bono, which we did for many years, and brought it back to financial stability. Trish moved on to other challenges, but I've been there for the past 16 years. And luckily, through the backing of the community, financial backing, we're able to now, we're extremely financially stable. We have over 3 years operating in the bank now.
Well, obviously, we're going to, you know, get into some more details about it, but it's certainly really great to hear, you know, your legal background and you use it for something so important. For the folks that don't know very much about Deidre's house and how it all started, you know, obviously very serious, very sad, tragic circumstances back in the early 80s. But what happened? How did Deidre's house even come about? What's the backstory behind it?
Well, Deidre's house is a nationally accredited child advocacy center. The whole idea behind a child advocacy center is to provide an environment where a child victim can be forensically interviewed, medically examined and treated, and clinically counseled, all under one roof, all free of charge, in a very non-traumatic setting. Because the whole idea is we don't want a child to be further traumatized by the very environment that is going to help them, and the very system that's trying to help them. So what came about was there was the then prosecutor at the Morris County Prosecutor's Office and some detectives that had been working with children that had been abused had heard about a model in Arkansas that was being used that didn't further traumatize children and provided an environment where children were felt free to tell their story. And they decided they wanted to bring that model to Morris County. So they first approached the Morris County freeholders for a site to build the center, which at that time was a dilapidated building on Court Street. And they said, if you give us access to this building, we can get donors and we will refurbish the building. At that time, Jim O'Brien was on the board of freeholders. Jim O'Brien had a very interesting journey to his position on the freeholders. His daughter, Deidre O'Brien, had been killed by a serial killer, James Kadadish, on her way home from her job at the Rockaway Town Square Mall. She had been sexually assaulted and left for dead. And before she passed away, she was found by a trucker, and she was able to give a description of her assailant. The interesting story and what brought them really to the forefront is when the case went to trial, at that time, there was no victim bill of rights in New Jersey. So the judge at that time actually barred the two moms, Georgia O'Brien and Amy Hoffman, Hoffman's mom, who had also been killed by James Kadadish, from the courtroom. At that time, and we, you know, looking back, it's unbelievable to know this, but at that time, there was no such thing as a victim impact statement. Jim O'Brien and George O'Brien became advocates in New Jersey for victims' rights, and they got the Victims' Rights Act passed along with Rich Pompilio. From there, Jim then decided he was going to run for Morris County Freeholder so he could influence how victims were treated in Morris County. So when the then prosecutor decided that he was going to try to found this child advocacy center, he approached Jim and Georgia O'Brien to try to spearhead the effort. Once it became apparent that this was going to come to fruition, he asked Jim and Georgia O'Brien if they could name the child advocacy center after their daughter, Deidre. So originally the name of the center was the Deidre O'Brien Child Advocacy Center, which is a mouthful. So when I came on in June 2003, I took a look at it and thought, how can we make this more victim-friendly and more easy for people to reach out? And we decided to change the name to Deidre's House.
And obviously, I mean, what a tragic circumstance for the O'Brien family. And are any of the O'Briens still with us? The mother, the kids, the dad, are they still involved at all?
George O'Brien is still with us. Jim passed away several years ago, but their family is still very involved with the center. And for me, every single day that I go to the center, I have a voice in my head, which is Jim and George O'Brien, that we always put the victim first. What Jim thought about on the day in April of 1996 when the center was actually dedicated, and then the then governor came and cut the ribbon, he had remembered some words that had been told to him that whenever God closes a window, he opens a door. Or closes a door and opens a window. And when he saw the ribbon being cut at that time, he saw the door being open. He thought, this is the door. This is the door being open. And if anything good could come out of the tragic death of his daughter, he knew that victims in Morris County would be treated with respect and kindness, and that their families could find some solace in the services that we provide at Deidre's House.
I mean, what could be more important for all of us is to protect the kids, especially those who are in need and those who sadly have been victimized. It's certainly a critically important thing. I know that you raised your family in Morris County. I'm blessed to raise my family in Morris County, and a lot of the listeners are in Morris County, and it's important, it's vitally important for them to know what Deidre's House, how it started and what it stands for, and the setting it provides for the young kids that have been so sadly victimized. In terms of, and I could see the passion in your face and in your voice, I mean, it sounds like this is just a life's mission for you. Did you envision, Maria, when you, I mean, obviously a very accomplished international lawyer, if I may, I mean, in China routinely back in the day, and how this kind of evolved for you since you've been the executive director for over 16 years. Did you ever envision your legal background would be used in this context?
No, actually I didn't. I always thought that my career would be in the area of business and corporate law. I never imagined that I would end up in this particular position. But once the opportunity was presented to me, it just fit so well with my philosophy of giving back. When I was in Washington, D.C., I was very fortunate that I actually had a job as a nanny for a family, and the Mason family, John and Joanne Mason. And they were very philanthropic people and believed in really giving back to their community. And that sense of giving back had always stayed with me. So when this position and this opportunity presented itself, I really became very passionate about the mission. And I always tell people that as much as I've given to Deidre's House, it's given much more to me because it's really given my life meaning.
Yeah, and once again, I mean, this is one of the things that I started the show is talk about wonderful people give back and actually to try to motivate others to get involved, because there's some wonderful, incredibly talented people in the area, and sometimes they don't know the outlet and how they can use God's gifts for what they can do to help others and help the community. And it was interesting, you know, I'd never met you before, but what was striking about what you're talking about is how you try to find solutions. You know, we live in a world where everybody can point out problems. I mean, Lord knows there's a lot of them, probably way too many problems. But we also have just incredibly talented people who have great ideas, and sometimes, you know, they don't step forward. But, you know, I think it's a great idea for those listening as we go through the show to think about getting involved, whatever you're into, whatever the passion is. For Maria, obviously, it's helping the kids. Maria, as the folks listening this morning to this obviously important show, if they want to contact you in Deidre's House, what's the best way for them to reach out?
First of all, we have a really great website. It's deidreshouse.org. And on that website, you'll find all the information about the services that we provide, how to contact us. We have a great explainer video that you can click on, and it will really show you the work that we do at Deidre's House and how to reach out for help. We provide services to children from every single municipality in Morris County. So a lot of people believe that, you know, it's a certain demographic of children that are particularly at risk demographically. And I try to tell people that a pedophile does not look at a child's bank account. Unfortunately, they're equal opportunity offenders. We have children from Dover, Morristown, Mendham, Bud Lake, Mount Olive, Flanders. It comes from every corner of Morris County. So it's important to know what services are available no matter where you are from Morris County. We also lend our services to children outside of Morris County if they do not have a child advocacy center in their community. We also work very closely with Homeland Security and the FBI, who also utilize the center because they do not have child-friendly settings in order to interview children that have been victimized in crimes that fall within the federal purview.
Yeah, and once again, I mean, there's an incredible need in the community for this. And what you also just said, which is, I think, obviously true, is sadly, these sick individuals preying on the kids cuts across all demographics. Am I right?
Absolutely. A pedophile does not look at a child's bank account.
Right. And that's what everybody needs to be aware of as well. So one of the things that I wanted to explore is, which I think is just really important for all of us, is because you've been doing this so long, is if someone thinks someone was a victim, if someone's acting differently, are there things that we all should be on the lookout for, you know, something going on? Because it could happen to anyone, anytime. You know, sadly, in the line of work that I'm in, being an attorney who handles some these types of cases on occasion from a civil perspective, it's just, it's so horrible what the kids go through, and many times there are signs. Are there some things that we all should be on the lookout for?
Absolutely. First of all, in New Jersey, everyone is what we call a mandated reporter. So if you suspect a child is being abused and neglected, legally you're obligated to report. And the way you report is you dial 1-877-NJ-ABUSE, and that'll take you to the hotline for the New Jersey Child Welfare. So it's New Jersey. We report to 1-877-NJ-ABUSE. If you call that hotline and you feel that you're not getting the answers, or you feel that they're not taking what you're talking about seriously, then call local law enforcement or the Morris County Prosecutor's Office. Some of the things that you should be looking at, and really, you have the opportunity, if you suspect a child is being abused or neglected, to save their lives. Too often, we see headlines where when a child dies, and you talk to neighbors or people that observed, and they say, well, we thought something odd was going on, but it wasn't any of our business, or we didn't interfere. Well, it is your business, and you need to report. Some of the things that you'll look at is, do you see a child out and they're not dressed properly for the weather? For instance, if we have cold weather and a child doesn't have a jacket, they don't have shoes on, or you see a child picking through the trash, that's a good indication that there's neglect. Or do you have a child that's having trouble sleeping at night, that's having behavioral changes? Or is there a young child that has sexual knowledge that they should not have? Are they describing things to you that they should not know about, that's developmentally not appropriate? So most of the times children will talk about this with a trusted adult. It could be a parent. It could be a neighbor, an aunt, an uncle. It could be a school counselor, an athletic coach, a teacher. So everyone is a mandated reporter. They could be telling their doctor. A lot of the times children will disclose to a physician because they feel comfortable telling a physician about their bodies. So everybody needs to be a mandated reporter. It's not just doctors, nurses, and school personnel. Anyone that observes something going on. We had a case years ago where there was a person that was working at Quick Check. And they noticed a child came in, and it appeared they had circular burns on their arms. And while they were actually at Quick Check, they called over to the hotline, and they reported. And the police were able to respond actually before the child left, and we found that the child had been being burned with cigarettes. And this Quick Check worker stepped up and reported what he was observing.
Right. And one of the things that I you just touched on, it's not just the horrible sexual abuse. It could be the physical abuse and neglect. Am I correct?
Absolutely.
Right. And also, it's also in the context of kids that are witnesses to violence in their environment as well.
Yes. So children that are witnessing any kind of violence, domestic violence, gang violence, those children we need to report too. a lot of the times when children are witnessing domestic violence, it can be just as deadly or just as damaging as physical or sexual violence. Those children are living in very high stress atmospheres, and they need help also. So what we say to people is, if you see something, say something. By doing so, you could be saving a child's life. And err on the side of caution. The way the law works is, if you have good faith suspicions and you report that, you will not be prosecuted. So even if you're wrong, you're not going to be prosecuted if you reported in good faith.
Right. And so for the listeners, this is so really, really important for all of us, is if you see something out of the ordinary, we all have these instincts, these gut reactions, something doesn't seem right. And what Maria is talking about is, if you have a neighbor or you're at a store or something is going on that doesn't seem right, you should get involved and you should notify the authorities so they can look into it and see if there is some basis for it. Because as Maria sadly has pointed out, many times, often, there's these signs. People say, oh, my God, it's not my business, or I'm really not sure. And then turns out, tragically, these horrible things could have been prevented. So once again, I mean, we all have to work together to make sure the kids are safe. In terms of the actual Deidre's house itself, the setting for it, so can you give us a scenario? Let's assume, sadly, a young person's been a victim of a sexual assault, and the authorities are notified. Where do the kids go for the interviews? How does that work?
Well, first of all, I want to just backtrack a little bit. And if you're going to report and you're unsure of how to report or you're reluctant to report, you can always call Deidre's house at 973-631-5000 or take a look at our website, deidreshouse.org, and you can call us and we can help you to report, or we can report on your behalf if you give us enough details. So when there's a suspicion of abuse or neglect, a child is brought to Deidre's house for the forensic interview. In Morris County, it's mandated that any child under the age of 12 must be interviewed at Deidre's house. If they're over the age of 12, it's left up to local law enforcement whether or not they want the child to be brought to Deidre's house. Most of the times, local law enforcement will bring the children to Deidre's house to be interviewed because they realize it's a much better environment to conduct the interview. Children are more likely to give the details of the abuse if they're in an atmosphere that they're comfortable in. Also, it's very critical that they be interviewed by detectives that are specially trained in the interviewing techniques of children, which is called finding words. Detectives at the Morris County Prosecutor's Office in the Sex Crimes and Child Endangerment Unit are specially trained in this technique. Again, it's called finding words. And it's a technique where they let the children tell their story in their own words without leading questions, which is critical. Because if the case goes to trial, you do not want a defense attorney to say that words were placed in the child's mouth. So you want the child to tell the story in their own words, in words that are developmentally appropriate for that child, in an atmosphere where they're comfortable talking about the stories that can often be very personal and very embarrassing. So you want them to be interviewed in specially decorated interview rooms. We have 3 interview rooms that are age appropriate. We have state-of-the-art interview equipment at the center that is is password protected. Only the detectives using it have access to it. My staff or myself, we never view an interview in real time. We do not have access to the recordings because we never want to be accused of any tainting of the interviews. So all the interviews are conducted by personnel and detectives from the Morris County Prosecutor's Office who are specially trained.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I know in Morris County they have a really great team of prosecutors, and I think it's important to follow the protocol. In terms of the staff at Deidre's house, so you serve as the executive director. How many other folks are there, like, let's say, today? I mean, are there people there manning the house?
So we have personnel that specialize in all different different areas of child abuse. We have two child advocates who are critical. They're bilingual, and they're the first contact with the child and family when they come in for the interview. And their job is to get the children comfortable so that when the detectives come over from the prosecutor's office, which is right next door, that the children feel comfortable enough to speak to the detectives, which is really critical because the way the law works, you only have one shot at the interview. So you can't bring a child in to be interviewed, stop the interview, and start it again. That taints the interview. So the child advocates who are bilingual, their job is to get the child comfortable enough. So when the children first come to us, they're led to a playroom. The child advocate will engage them in puzzles and video games and Lego and get them really comfortable in the setting. Then they will be interviewed. After the interview, the children will be approached, and the parents or the non-offending caregivers, because we never let offenders in the building, will be approached, and the children will be offered medical examinations and treatment. That medical examination and treatment is conducted at Deidre's house in our clinic by a pediatrician who is specially trained in the diagnosis and treatment of child abuse. And she's critical, because she also becomes the expert witness of choice once this goes to trial. She is specially trained in diagnosing and recognizing the signs that an abuse has occurred. She's also critical because she can reassure the child that whatever injuries that they've occurred will heal, and no one from the outside will be able to know that they're a victim of abuse.
Right. I mean, obviously, the privacy is critically important as well, since you don't want to victimize the victim further. It sounds to me, Maria, that you got quite a team together there. Obviously, I'm serving our great county in so many ways. Are there volunteers also that are part and parcel of the Deidre House team?
Yes, there are volunteers. But before I get to the role of volunteers, I want to also emphasize that we have five clinicians on staff, three of which are bilingual. This is really, really critical, because a child, in order to heal from the abuse that they've suffered, they need to process it in a healthy way. And our clinicians guide them along this path. When the children come to us, they're in a really dark place, and our clinicians have to reach in and draw them out. What we say is our primary mission is that a child's life may be altered by abuse, but we do not want their life to be defined by that. And the only way that their life will not be defined by that is if they get the counseling that they need at the time that the abuse has occurred, or as soon as we can possibly administer that kind of help after the disclosure. And we stay with the children for many, many months and sometimes years, because children in particular process abuse differently and process trauma differently than adults. It takes them much longer to process the trauma that they've gone through. Unfortunately, in New Jersey and in Morris County, we're facing a crisis where there is really a lack of mental health services for children and teenagers and adolescents. And unfortunately, when a child does not get the kind of help that they need at the time that the trauma has occurred, they start to engage in behaviors that are unhealthy, like self-harm or suicidal ideation, or actually victimizing other children. So it is very, very critical that children receive the clinical counseling that they need at the time of the abuse.
Yeah, I know. We were talking, Maria, before we started this morning, because we both live in Morris County and have some common friends, and we were talking about the tragedies in Mendham and how we realized, the community realized, we need to do more to help the kids and the parents and their community. And you touched on something. Hopefully we're going to explore in some additional shows in the very, very near future about the issue of the mental health of the kids going through the school system in Morris County, since it's really a nationwide issue, but we also see painfully clear what's going on locally as well. And is that your experience, that there's these a commonality with this mental health issue and how it's kind of affecting the community in many ways?
Absolutely. one of the things that we have to recognize is that we have a mental health crisis in this country and in New Jersey and in our county, where there's a lack of mental health services for children and adolescents, especially affordable mental health services. What we at Deja's House do is all of our services, all of them, are free of charge. We never, ever charge for any of our services. So we do not look at a child's ability to pay.
We're going to be right back with Maria Savatier and the great work at the Deja's House. We'll be back in 30 seconds.
The Todd Leonard Show is sponsored by the Leonard Foundation, whose mission is to support the children and families who are battling pediatric cancer and those in need of food and assistance, women's shelters, and other important social services in the community. They also proudly support those fighting pancreatic cancer. They feel it's vitally important to help those in need in our amazing community when they need us the most. Please join them in extending a helping hand and go to leonardcharity.org and donate now. Together, we can touch many lives.
Maria, thank you again. This is a really great segment. And you were just talking about how the kids who really desperately need this help to heal and to do their best to obviously not let them have their entire life affected by the trauma, that their services they receive are free. And how does that come about? Where's the funds for that? Because I think that's important for all of us to hear the generosity of the community. Because, I mean, this is once again the thing that I don't think everybody realizes, what a giving community we have. So can you talk about that?
Sure. So Deja's House is a 501c3 not-for-profit. So what that means is every year I have to raise every single dollar that goes to services. Right now our budget is about $700,000 a year. 93 cents of every dollar donated goes directly to services. And I have to say, Deja's House would not have survived without the generosity of the community. When I came on in June 2003, we had only $15,000 in the bank. In order to keep Deja's House going, I basically took out my Rolodex and started calling people, particularly in Mendham, Chester, Far Hills, in the community that I lived in, and reached out to people. And people really were supportive, and without the support, the grassroots support of the community, we could not have survived. It gave us the time for me to be able to then go out and get larger grants. So those $100, $500, $1,000 donations kept us going for many, many years until I was able to write grants to get into the pipeline. Back now in 2020, we have not only the support of our community, but we have corporations like the pharmaceuticals in Morris County, Novartis, Merck, Sanofi, Aventis, Bayer, who have been great supporters, but also now the county and the state have given us significant support so that we can provide mental health services to the community. A lot of the times what we see is if we did not provide clinical counseling to children, there would be nowhere for them to go. So it's very critical. And when I present to the freeholders or to the state, I really let them know that in this particular instance, when it comes to mental health of child abuse victims or children that have experienced any kind of trauma, we can pay now or we can pay later. But at some point, as a society, we have to pay. And that message, thankfully, has really hit a chord with our donors. And they have been super, super supportive. And so we have been able, when I first came on, we had no clinicians on staff at all. And now we have five. And that is really due in 100% to the generosity of our community, to individual donors, to foundations, to corporations. We could not do it. Every single dollar donated counts.
Yeah, Maria, also, though, I think it's also with your passion and devotion to the kids. I talk about this with people sometimes, this life's journey. You start doing one thing and all of a sudden, you know, you're doing something totally different. But I could see how passionate and how, you know, you feel so strongly about helping the kids, which I think was certainly instrumental in growing the program. Because as you said, if you don't take care of it now, we're all of us as a society, we are going to suffer if we don't take care of the kids. I mean, if we can't do that, we got some major problems. In terms of what the what the Deidre House offers by way of programs, and really from what my research revealed, there's a lot of different things you do to help the kids, you know, with the various clinicians and the experts, because obviously you need the right expertise.
Right.
Everybody wants to do right, but you need the right folks to actually give the vitally important care immediately to help these kids heal. So what kind of programs are offered for the kids?
Well, our advocacy program is made up of first the forensic interviewing piece, then we through a very generous donation from the William Simon Foundation, we were able to provide medical examinations and treatment for the children. And then we have clinical counseling. And the clinical counseling program is sponsored by private donors and corporations, donors like the Margaret Darren Foundation, Doug Kimmelman, and the Kimmelman Family Foundation, the Chan Family Foundation, the Connell Company, and monies that we raise at our annual gala every November. We have individuals who actually sponsor the clinical counseling program. And we also have different funds. We have the Healing Fund, we have the Shine Fund, and the Deer Camp Fund. Those funds are specifically set aside to give direct assistance to victims. The Healing Fund, in, for instance, we had a child, and this is one of the reasons we started it. Her hair was all burnt, had been burned off by her dad. And we were approached by child welfare because they could not provide assistance to give her a wig so she could go back to school because it was deemed cosmetic. And a wig cost about $150. So we were able to provide that assistance to her because all she really wanted to do was go back to school. And she wanted to go back to school, but she needed to do something about her appearance. So we started the Healing Fund, which people, you can make a difference by donating $50, $100. Another fund we have is the Deer Camp Fund, which sponsors children to go to their summer camp of their choosing so that they can go to a camp and they don't have to be identified or held out as a child abuse victim. Unfortunately, some of the cases are very high profile and the cases end up in the newspaper. And kids just want to go to a camp where they can be anonymous and the fingers aren't pointed out, oh, that's what they were talking about. That's the child that was in the newspaper. We then expanded that program to Shine, which we sponsor children for extracurricular activities. Just for instance, there were some great students at Mendham High School who did a bake sale on behalf of Deidre's House. And with that money, they were able to sponsor a child to go to camp. So it's children helping other children. Every single dollar that's donated, like I said, 93 cents of every dollar goes directly to child victims. And this is, again, where volunteers come in. Volunteers, one of the most vital things they can do is just get the word out about Deidre's House and that we exist and to help us with our fundraising efforts. One of our largest donations was by the Charles Lafitte Foundation and the Citron family. And how did they get to us? They donated $350,000, and the way they got to us was they were talking about some friends who had heard about Deidre's House, and they said, this is a great organization that you should investigate. And the Citrons came to visit us, and they decided that we would be the recipients of their annual golf outing. And that was just somebody who decided to tell the Citrons about us. Volunteers also help us with what we call days of caring. They come in, and it's mostly corporate groups or civil service groups, and they come in and they dedicate a day of caring, and they allow us to accomplish tasks inside the center that we could not necessarily do because we have a small staff. We only have 8 people. So for instance, if we have new furniture for the playroom and we've ordered it and it needs to be put together, they come in and they help us put it together, or they come and they do plantings in our play yard, or they help us sterilize surfaces, which is really critical because we have so many kids that come through, especially in flu season, we have to continually sterilize surfaces. Or they do snack drives and they collect healthy snacks for us. So there's many, many ways that you can get involved, and those ways are described again on our website, deidreshouse.org.
Right. So once again, Maria, if folks that are listening, hopefully we're inspiring many of the listeners today to really, you know, keep their eyes open and make sure that the kids are not being victimized. But if this is touching people's hearts, which I believe it will, because it's touching my heart again, learning more about the incredible work, and if they want to donate, what would they do if they want to step up and donate some money to help?
Well, there's different ways. You can call us at 973-631-5000 and you can give a credit card. You can go onto our website and hit the donate now button. You can donate. We just had recently a stock donation, which was really fabulous. You can, donate healthy snacks, which is really helpful for us because we don't have to use, money that should go directly to programming by just going to Costco and getting individually wrapped snacks or small waters or low sugar or juice drinks and just bringing them over. A lot of the times high school students or middle school students get involved by sponsoring snack drives or they also gift card drives which we can use when families are in crisis, grocery cards, gas cards. There's many, many ways you can get involved. And again, I refer you to our website, which has a whole list of ways you can donate and get involved.
Yeah, you know, I learned about your great organization a number of months ago, and I knew there was a shortage of water, so obviously I went to local supermarket and loaded up the car and off I went to your facility. And it was just a very small token, but I realized for the listeners there's a lot of ways that we can all get together and help your wonderful work that the Deidre House does every day to help the kids in need. You know, you said something also that struck me, which is the kids, you know, helping other kids, you know, raising money, raising awareness. And, you know, you've been involved in, you know, over 16 years as the executive director. And I want to get your perspective on this because, you know, I always want to talk about the positive in life. You know, there's enough negativity. You turn on the news, you want to throw your TV or your computer out the window. But how do you feel, you know, seeing the youngsters, the kids, helping other kids over the years in terms of your view of the future for all of us?
You know, one of the most rewarding things for me is when I go into a school and I talk about the work of Deidre's House and I talk about how the kids can help. And I have to say that the kids, you can hear a pin drop in the room because they really do care. They really do want to help. And for me to know that the next generation, that when I'm gone and I retire, that the next generation will really step up and they will take care of each other, it's so important to see. And I have to tell you that when I go into the schools, it's so touching to me. And when I tell the story about Deidre's House and I see the kids and they're really paying attention and they really care and they really want to help, that a lot of times it brings me to tears. Because I see that they really care. And one of the things that also touches me is the amount of concern that kids have for what's going on in their community. They're worried about gun violence. They're worried about bullying and cyberbullying. They are worried about how it affects not only themselves, but their fellow students. And so we go out from Deidre's House, myself and Morella Diaz, who is also one of our clinicians who does outreach and education, and we go out on a weekly basis and we talk to elementary school students, middle school students, and high school students about the effects of cyberbullying and child abuse in our community, and not only how they can keep themselves safe, but how they can help each other. One of the things that we always stress is there's a lot of things that kids cannot control in their lives. There's, you know, they have to listen to their parents, they have to listen to their teachers, but one of the things that they can control is how they treat each other, how they can show kindness and caring and respect to each other. And that really can change a toxic school environment to a caring school environment. And this is something that we emphasize to the kids, that they can control. As a community, they dictate how they treat each other and how kindness really counts. And just a kind word to one of their fellow students when a child is struggling can go a long way. You know, in Mendham, we just saw the tragedy of two suicides. We've had three suicides in Mendham since September. And I can't emphasize enough that when you see a child that is struggling, just showing concern or a kind word can change the whole trajectory of their life. So we really try to emphasize to kids that they have the opportunity to really help their fellow students. And we go out and we talk about this every single day. As a community, we sometimes can't prevent bad things happening. But as a community, we can make sure that in the aftermath, that we gather together as a community and we make significant changes and we support those who are suffering.
Yeah, so that was something we were talking about even before we started, and it was great to meet you this morning for the first time, is about how all this stuff is related, the bullying, the mental health, the abuse, people not really watching out for each other and to lend a hand up. And you touched on something, you know, I'm 56. I hope that's still young because my kids joke about my age a little bit, but we had no such thing as cyberbullying, and we really just candidly, you know, you went to school, you went home, and then you saw your friends again the next day. And I know that's a huge issue now because it causes the kids to feel ostracized, kids feel left out, kids don't know how to cope with that. And then one thing leads to another. It could be violent outbursts. It could be, sadly, a self-destructive behavior. They could be, you know, self-harming themselves in many different ways. We talked a little bit about, a lot today about the kids getting abused and people not having their eyes open for each other, because we are really in this together. And one of the things that you touched on, which, you know, when I was doing the research for the show, one of the mantras of your great organization is education, and then there is prevention and awareness. And I want to touch on that too, because it's not just Deidre's house, it's the whole community. I think we'll have to really recognize these three tenets for all of us to try to follow as we go through life. So you mentioned education. So you actually go into the schools with your colleague and you try to educate, am I right?
Yes, absolutely. So we have presentations that we give in schools in Morris County directly on child abuse prevention and cyberbullying, which is really, really critical. Because what we look at it is cyberbullying is just another form of child abuse. It's when a child is abusing another child. And I've been doing this for 16 years, and I have to tell you that most of the cases that we're seeing are not strangers abusing children. It's children being abused by someone they know. And unfortunately, one of the biggest trends that we've seen is children abusing other children, abusing them not only sexually, but emotionally. And I'm 56 years old too. And I know when I was in school, if I was having difficulties in school, I went home and that was a safe haven. But one of the things that kids are facing today, which creates long-lasting psychological effects, is that cyberbullying and bullying in general is relentless, because the bully can reach that child 24/7 through social media, through posts, through texting. The child feels that there is no place that is safe, because they can be sitting at dinner with their family, they can be in their bedroom, they can be on vacation, they can be in the back of their parents' car, and the bully can reach them. It's relentless. And a lot of the times kids are exhibiting in suicidal behavior because they feel there is no escape. There is no place that is safe. And we as adults have to recognize that. And we as a community have to understand that we need to get to the root of the problem by not having the child that is being bullied being more ostracized by taking away their technology so that they don't feel connected. But we really have to recognize as parents when our children are exhibiting this type of behavior and that it's not acceptable. You know, we always talk about the golden rule, treat each other as you would want to be treated. As parents, you can't always get ahead of technology. Kids are always going to be ahead of us. There's always the thing that we don't understand or websites or apps that they're using. But if we have the basic tenet to treat each other as we would want to be treated, and we really tell kids, do not say online or in social media something that you would not be comfortable saying to a person's face.
Yeah, I mean, that just not only goes for kids, but adults as well.
I mean,
you go on Facebook, whatever, Instagram, whatever you're into social media wise, and it's pretty, it's striking, it's sad, just the level of vitriol. And you said, like, if you were in someone's same presence, they would never say that, but
never.
Somehow they're sitting in the comfort of wherever the heck they're at, and they say the most vile, disgusting things, and don't realize how it causes this culture, the denigration of the culture. You know, I had the D'Amico family on, Laura and Chris D'Amico. They tragically lost their son in June of 2015 in a tragic accident. And we talked about the Kindness for Christopher movement. And, you know, I drive every day to work in Denville, on Millbrook, and I see by the high school, be kind. And it's just two words. And I say to myself, wow, I mean, if that doesn't strike a chord also, because it's like you said, the golden rule. If we're all kind to each other, a lot of these problems will hopefully over time start to be minimized more and more. I realize we don't live in a perfect world. I wanted to touch on, too, besides education, which I think is vitally important for all of us. I know we all have to teach our kids and teach our peers and everybody else, you know, to try to be good people and do the right thing and keep your eyes open. This concept of prevention, which is one of your key mantras, too, to your great organization. Obviously, to try to prevent something is what could be more important. And by the way, as an aside, you look really good for 56. I just want to say that. I've been very fortunate. A lot of my guests, they're around my age, and I guess they're beautiful people, so it shows on the outside as well. Prevention. What are your thoughts about prevention?
Well, this is another thing that's really rooted in education. So we go out into the community, we talk to teachers, school counselors, daycare workers, people that are in civic groups, and we talk about how to keep children safe, how to keep children from being victimized, how to keep children from being re-victimized, because once a child becomes a victim, they're more susceptible to be re-victimized. And really, it's as a community that we're committed to keeping children safe and creating environments where also children, if they see something or are uncomfortable about something, they can go to a trusted adult and tell them about it, that it's going to be accepted, that they're not going to feel like they shouldn't be talking about these particular subjects. So we always tell kids, and this is a great way of prevention, that if you're uncomfortable about something or you feel something, it just gives you a pit in your stomach, go to a trusted adult, go to an older sibling, talk about it. We all have a responsibility to keep children safe. The other thing that we can do too is demand that the media not be over-sexualizing our kids. Unfortunately, we've seen a rise in children on child-on-child sexual abuse, and that comes from the desensitizing children to sexualized attitudes and sexualized activity. We do not want children who are developmentally not able to handle sexual acts being susceptible to pornography or media that promotes that. So I think one of the biggest things is keeping children off sites that sexualize them prematurely and keeping them off watching movies or TV shows that are presenting material that children are not ready developmentally to really absorb.
No question about it. I mean, we'll have to watch what the kids are looking at. And as parents, we have to make sure we're doing our very best to not have the kids grow up so fast, because they're not ready for it. And it ends up, as you just touched on, causing a lot of other potential issues. I wanted to talk about maybe something a little more upbeat is how you feel when a child is able to overcome the trauma they've suffered through the great works. How does you and your team feel when you're able to do that?
For us, the success stories that we have keep us going through the most difficult cases in the darkest days. We have children that have been highly, highly successful because we've been able to intervene with them at an early time. We have children that are now adults that are living happy, healthy lives, and they've healed. Why? Because we've given them the services they needed at the time that the trauma has occurred. I can't emphasize that enough. There was an ACE study that talked about childhood trauma and how it affects adults, its adverse childhood experiences. And what this study found is that if you treat a child at the time that the trauma occurred, that child goes on to to live a healthy, successful life. And that really is what keeps us going. And we keep in touch with our kids as they go into adulthood. And we really try to maintain relationships with them. And for me and my staff, that makes it all worth it. And we're dealing with the most difficult cases. People say, how do you do it? And I say, the fact that we can make a difference in that child's life and we can give them the tools to heal from the trauma that they suffered, that's what keeps my staff going each and every day.
Yeah, God bless you and your passion and everybody that stands so strongly behind Deidre's House mission, from such horrible heartache to really reaching the community. God bless the O'Brien family as well, who obviously still carry on the legacy, you know, of how important that is to continue to for many, many years to come. You know, you talked about the volunteers and you talk about the donors and you talk about just the local folks who give back. How important do you think they are to the vibrancy of the community, the volunteers?
They're absolutely critical. We could not do what we do without the support of the community. I cannot emphasize that enough. Not only the monetary donations, but the volunteers that come and help us with the Days of Caring at the center, who do the snack drives, who help us get the word out, who come and support our events that we have each year, our gala, our wine and whiskey tasting, our golf outing. And not only that, but when we have the support of the community, it's that support that gives us the strength to continue to do the difficult work that we do. It continues to inspire us each and every day and give us the fortitude for myself or my staff to continue on. The community support is critical. I cannot emphasize that enough. So again, keep supporting the nonprofits that you care about. It doesn't matter if it's Deidre's House or any other nonprofit in the community. You support what you're passionate about, and when you're passionate about something, you give lifeblood to the nonprofits that are actually doing that grassroots work. And again, if you see something, if you suspect a child is being abused or neglected, you could save that child's life. So either dial 1-877-NJ-ABUSE, contact your local law enforcement or prosecutor's office, or if you just don't know where to turn, again, call 973-631-5000. Call Deidre's House. Speak to our child advocate. Or you can ask for me. I take calls each and every day, and I give people advice as to what to do if they suspect a child is being abused or neglected.
So, and once again, obviously, your commitment, I can hear, you know, everybody listening knows your passion from listening to the show today. I also know you have surprised some incredible board members as well that are really, really make this their passion as well. How many board members do you have, Maria?
We have 16 board members, and they come and they specialize in all different disciplines. We have attorneys, we have human resource specialists, we have community activists. We have people in, you know, that are just business people. And without the support of our board, who really rally around us, especially in fundraising and with special events, we could not do what we do. Nancy Miller Rich, Nicolette Sherman, Stephanie Caravella, Gina Tedesco, Richard Gentles, one of our longest standing board members, Pat Solar, Sue Schneider, who's been with us forever, Ed Ziff, who's a local attorney in town. We could not do what we do without the support of our board.
Yeah, and you know, you touch on something, is whatever you're into, I mean, whatever your passion is in life, you know, there's so many different organizations out there that you can give back. You know, I've been involved in Special Olympics basketball for 20 plus years and got involved a number of years ago with the 200 Club in Morris County because I just love the first responder community. That gets me going. Obviously, pediatric cancer, anybody battling, sadly, with young kids, started a foundation to try to make a difference, to make the world better. You know, I think that's really important. You also said something that also I just want to explore briefly, is that Deidre House is still not everybody in Morris County knows it exists. So we want to spread the word. So I wanted to say, you know, Maria, it meant the world that you came on the show today. Hopefully the listeners learned so much about Deidre's House And if they need to reach out, they should reach out to you and the wonderful things you do. Also want to tell the listeners once again, we're in this together. We live in a world where we got to come together. We got to be kind. We have to be generous. We have to give from the heart. I talked about last week's show about New Year's resolutions. Why don't we make a resolution to continue to work together? Deidre's House is an example of something right here in Morris County. We're in this together. Next week, we're going to have Billy Cook and Phyllis Cook come on and talk about Billy's Baseballs, a wonderful young kid who started a great idea, and we're going to talk about giving back. I want to wish everyone an incredible rest of the weekend. Enjoy this amazing weather. And Maria, once again, God bless you and everybody else helping the kids. Look forward to everyone joining us next week. God bless.
Thanks, Todd.